Hi, Alison.
Hi, Sarah. So the French Parliament is debating changing the law on end-of-life care, maybe allowing assisted suicide here.
Ooh, a controversial subject. Yeah, we've talked about this on the show before.
Yeah, at the end of the month, MPs will be voting on two separate bills, one on palliative care, which is severely lacking in France, and the other on assisted dying and euthanasia.
Very linked subjects. Mm-hmm. The current French law allows for terminally ill patients to receive deep and continuous sedation, but euthanasia, where a doctor administers a lethal drug, and assisted suicide, where the patient is helped to do it themselves, those are both currently illegal.
Now, there have been increasing calls for a change in the law, including from some terminally ill patients who say they're being forced to go abroad to countries like Belgium or Switzerland to be able to end their lives, meaning that there's a sort of two-tier system in operation.
Yeah, so when he was elected, President Emmanuel Macron promised there'd be a debate and a parliamentary vote on the question.
Yeah, and to prepare for that, well, he launched a citizens' convention or assembly on the issue. That was in late 2022. 184 people were chosen at random, representing a sort of cross-section of the French population. They met 27 times over 4 months, and they basically had to answer the question of whether the current system was satisfactory or not. So they spoke to all kinds of experts, they debated, and they delivered their conclusions to Macron in April 2023. They almost unanimously favoured improving access to palliative care, no surprise on that, but three quarters of them supported access to both assisted suicide and euthanasia under, of course, very tight conditions.
Okay, so this is more or less reflecting, you know, public opinion that we've seen in surveys. Though the Catholic Church remains very opposed to assisted dying, and the medical community is still divided, as are lawmakers.
Yeah, it's more or less divided along the right-left political line.
Yeah.
In terms of methodology, then, this was France's second experiment, in fact, in deliberative democracy. The first was held in 2019-2020 with the Citizens' Assembly on Climate.
Yeah, we did look at that in the podcast, and right, I remember the conclusion was a bit disappointing, right, for some of the participants. Only a small number of the measures they all came up with were accepted by the government and became law. What about this citizens' convention? Will it be better heated?
Possibly. Mm. It was more clearly stated this time round that the Assembly would be providing counsel and not creating legislation. What's for sure is that the participants themselves found the process rather enriching. I spoke to Marc-Olivier Strauss-Kahn. He's a 71-year-old economist who was one of the members. I talked to him about how taking part in the assembly affected his own stance on end-of-life care. He said that when he was first called to take part in November 2022, he was very curious, and then he was enthusiastic because he was interested in the subject, but also the format of the consultation. I mean, how could strangers with such diverse points of view work together on this very intimate subject and reach conclusions?
I wondered how it was possible that they were needing to be representative of the diversity of people in France to have one more old, white, male retired in Paris. I thought there would be many. And I was told that there were not so many because elder people sometimes don't want to discuss about this because they are closer to this situation. We worked for 27 days, 9 weekends of 3 days of interaction and interactions via WhatsApp and other virtual tools in between. I met people that I might never have met or discussed with. There were some people who had difficulties to understand all the words, so there was an effort done by everybody. And the environment, the way we were prepared and could discuss, was very helpful to promote everybody. It's really the best social experience of my life. And I really believe that the importance, the intimacy of the topic helped us to respect the views of the other because there is no right or wrong.
So what was your position on end of life at the beginning, and in what ways did it evolve or change during those debates?
I had a positive prior in favor of assisted dying. I didn't know the nuance between assisted dying and euthanasia at that time, that now we call altogether medical help for dying. Now it is a more grounded, less emotional view. We all became expert in our views. So some changed their views during that time.
And you?
In my case, I tended to be more supportive of it because I discovered how much there are obstacles to be overcome in this process.
Access to medicine,
the process, and knowledge about it, information, training of the people. And it's a long-term process. It started in France more than 45 years ago, and we are still discussing it. Some people arguing that it's a process which is rushed. It's not rushed. It is even the reverse that happens. There is procrastination, both for palliative care and medical help for dying.
Was there a moment during all those debates which helped you to modify slightly your position?
There are many things. Visit to patients, hearings. We had 60 hearings with health professionals, lawyers, philosophers, religious people. And the testimony of many people speaking about their own experience was really moving. And I have to confess that several times I cried. Now, if I think about one moment when I was negatively impressed was by the group of religious heads of six religions we heard, and who all referred to this well-known formula, you shall not kill, you shall not rob. And then the answer or the question by a philosopher who said, when it's your own money, you are not robbing yourself. When it's your own life, you're not killing. It's your own liberty to decide what you want. That was for me, it helped me understand better the differences of views.
In the report that you handed over to President Macron at the end of the convention, there was broad agreement that palliative care needs to be much improved and much more widely available. There was less agreement on the issue of whether or not to open up assisted suicide and euthanasia in France. 76% of the 184 members were in favour of that. So that means roughly one quarter of the Citizens' Convention were not in favour.
So almost unanimous to consider that the framework had to be improved. 95% in favour of extensive palliative care, and this would apply to most cases in the population. 76% indeed in favour of medical help for dying as an ultimate resort in a process which has to be very strictly defined, and seeing this ultimate care as complementary to the palliative care. Now, indeed, there were 23% against it, and that was respected. Now, the arguments of those who are against, generally, they refer to the fear of drifts. Any time you open a door, and this is why the large majority took that into account in defining very strictly the process that would control the evolution of people having to confirm that they are in favor of being helped for dying. And one of the key speakers of this view thanked at the end the majority to have given to the minority an equal time to speak and to express their views, which is for me the best acknowledgement of the respect that presided in our discussions. At the same time, the so-called representative democracy, our elected members in the parliament, were shouting And the contrast made us very proud of our respect for each other.
From that perspective, actually, this citizens' assembly, this way of conducting what we call deliberative democracy, do you see it as a model that probably Parliament should be following? Because there's a very poor culture of consensus in France. We know that.
So first, in our deliberative process, we very quickly were confronted with the idea, shall we try and reach a consensus, or shall we accept and clarify the contrary, which is a dissensus, a word that we were not used to. And we realized that it was better to clarify any dissensus, express the arguments for and against, and assess how many were in favor. Of course, we do not represent France, but we are sort of mirror of France because we were reflecting the diversity of views and backgrounds. And I think that we are going through a crisis of representative democracy. The idea is not to replace representative democracy by deliberative democracy, but just to involve more the citizens as a help, as a complementary approach.
Now, there was a previous citizens' convention to discuss climate in 2019, 2020. There was a lot of enthusiasm, and then in the end, around only 10% of their proposals were accepted by the government without being modified. With this one, do you feel more confident that you have been listened to?
Without the convention, there would not have been an improvement in the process of palliative care. Why? Because a 10-year strategic plan has become implemented, adding 100 million euro per year, the total amount of almost 6 billion over 10 years, and that will definitely improve the situation. As regards the question of medical help for dying, we know that the members of parliament, the media, refer to our arguments, whether for and against. We are meeting members of parliament, and we are trying to help and contribute to the next convention in order to draw lessons from what went well and could be improved.
So what could be improved?
There are many things which could be improved in terms of the interaction between the members of the convention and the members of the parliament, some which may think that we are competing with them. One thing in favor of the future convention, I hope they will go as well as ours in terms of personal development and contribution to better thinking in our society. And if I have one thing to recommend to people, if there is a phone call that is not clearly a commercial, take it and try to participate because it's a unique chance in your life.
So he's really enthusiastic about mm-hmm. this experience. It sounded like it was really moving for him. And he mentions, and you guys, both of you mentioned this next citizens' assembly. This one will be about how children's well-being and health, specifically how they spend their time. One of the issues will be shortening school holidays, for example, but there will also be questions of screens and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so they've just begun calling people up to take part in that assembly. In theory, it'll be a lot less controversial than the end of life, but it could well still be very complicated. J'ai toujours préféré aux voisins les voisines dont les ombres chinoises ondulent sur les volets. Je me suis inventé un amour pantomime où glissent en or et noir tes bas sur tes mollets. De ma fenêtre en face, je caresse le plexiglas.
So, Allison, you live in an apartment building. How well do you know your neighbor?
I know my immediate neighbor, but I have to say that even though I've been in the building 5 years, I still probably only know about 10 people.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we moved in just after COVID, and I think that people had sort of got out of the habit of mixing, really. So it has not been easy.
It hasn't been easy. Mm. Well, yeah, I actually feel like I know mine pretty well. I have been in my building a bit longer, and I have gotten to know know them through these occasional meetings we have out in the courtyard around a drink. Mm. Turns out there's a dedicated date for that.
Yeah, the fête des voisins, yeah. The neighbor's party, which we do not have in our building.
Ah.
Anyway, maybe that's part of the problem. It's the last Friday of May, and this year it's, well, tomorrow.
Yeah, and it will be the 25th anniversary. The idea of this neighbor's party, which, you know, to be honest, is not the day my building usually organizes our own meetups. But the idea is that you get together with your neighbors from the building, from the neighborhood, to get to know each other. Mm. 5,000 cities and towns across France today officially encourage this. Other European cities, it's caught on. And it all started with this one guy, Athanase Perifon. He's a local town representative in the 17th district of Paris in the north of the city. And he was horrified to learn that an elderly woman in his neighborhood had died, but her body hadn't been found for 4 months. And for him, it showed that neighbors didn't know each other well enough. Otherwise, someone would have checked in on her. So he decided to get to know his own neighbors. And it started out pretty badly.
I decided to put a table on the street. I made a lot of flyers in all the buildings of the streets. At 7 o'clock, nobody. I was alone with my orange juice. It was terrible. At 30 past 7, lady come. I said, oh, welcome to my neighbor's day. She looks around and she said, oh, there is nobody here. And she go down. At 8 o'clock, we were 25 people. At 10 o'clock, all the neighbors said, why we wait so long time to meet? And at 11 o'clock p.m., nobody want to go home.
So this one gathering turned into a nationwide phenomenon.
Just like that. Yes,
of course.
Yeah, well, but not everyone has the drive, perhaps, of Athanase. But I guess he was already in local office. He has a penchant for organizing. He really wanted to spread the concept. So he got on the phone. He called up mayors. He drove around to meet them. And by the next year, the year 2000, he'd managed to get 20 cities on board. And the first official Fête des Voisins was on.
I feel like the idea of isolation and solidarity kind of came to the fore in 2003 with that heat wave. You know, we've talked about that on the podcast, haven't we? That August, temperatures rose to a staggering 37 degrees Celsius for 8 days in a row across the country. And nearly 15,000 people in France died from the heat.
Yeah, and most of them were elderly people. Mm. And while most of those deaths were actually in retirement homes, what everyone does remember of these terrible stories of people in Paris in particular who, you know, couldn't leave the city on holiday because they didn't have the resources or didn't have the mobility, couldn't even leave their apartments, and they died alone. No one was there to check on them. Athanase told me that the 2003 heat wave really jump-started this idea of the Fête des Voisins.
People, for all the, on the TV, on the reports, etc., said, but what's happened? If I knew my neighbor, he didn't dead, because he's dead alone without water. And it was for the neighbor's day, an accelerator. People said, yes, it's very important to meet the neighbors. And in 2003, neighbor's day make an incredible ascension.
So today, 25 years later, we have social media, we've got online tools. So the Fête des Voisins in person, it's nonetheless still a thing.
Yeah, because social media, right, doesn't replace knowing who you're living with. Athanase actually says social media has helped the spread of the concept.
It's a paradox. We must use all these tools. Without the social media, without the social network, the neighbor's day can't be in all the country, really. But we must be very attentive to speak with people who is so near than you. We can't live alone.
His organization has now taken up the issue of volunteering. So they've introduced a civic hour in which everyone, you know, pledges to give an hour a month to something in the community. They did this in a few departments this year. 20,000 people took part, he says, and they're hoping to spread it beyond, make it another nationwide thing. Mm-hmm. He says this taps into a need for services, first of all. Public services are stretched thin in France. Elderly people are increasingly left to fend for themselves. And also volunteerism fills a need in the general public.
It's between family solidarity, first step of solidarity, the institution solidarity, you pay your taxes to help poor people, of course, but it's not enough. You must have also this solidarity, local solidarity. And when the three levels, family, state, and neighbors, could be in action together, it will be more easy.
So we're hearing the tune. Mm-hmm. It means it's that time of year again, the Cannes Film Festival.
Where movie stars and the film industry gather on the French Riviera.
Yeah, the grand prize for the festival is the Palme d'Or, the Golden Palm, which was first awarded 70 years ago on May 10th, 1955. Previously, the prize was just called the Grand Prix. But the festival wanted an award designed in tribute to the coat of arms of the city of Cannes. And in 1955, that very first Palme d'Or went to the American film Marty, directed by Delbert Mann. And the president of the jury that awarded that prize that year was Marcel Pagnol.
Pagnol, the famed French novelist.
And filmmaker, It turns out. This year's festival is in full swing. Our colleague Olia Horton is there. And one of the films screened is a biopic of Pagnol.
It's called Marcel et Monsieur Pagnol, Marcel and Mr. Pagnol, A Magnificent Life. It brings really to life to the screen the French novelist, who was also a filmmaker. You'll know his name from works like My Father's Glory, Manon des Sources. He was known as a playwright as well. And this is really a sketch of basically the main events throughout his life. He was born in 1895 in Aubagne, in the hills near Marseille. So we're in the south of France, which is where we are here in Cannes as well. And he was born at the same time as the nascent film industry. So he made his name in theatre. He wrote books, but he caught the cinema bug really early on with the arrival of the talkies, and he actually went over to London to see his very first talkie film, and he totally fell in love with it. He ended up opening his own film studio near Marseille, and all throughout the film we can see how attached he is to his native Provence and his very loyal group of friends who work with him. I was able to speak to one of the producers of the film, Aton Soumache, and he told me that the idea for this film actually came from Pagnol's grandson, Nicolas. And the resulting film is 8 years in the making, and it really is a tribute to the movies.
This movie is a tribute to cinema. Marcel Pagnol, just, you know, born in 1895 when the movie was created, and it goes through all his life. So it's incredible to see an artist who is discovering the new technology of his life and will go from play, discover movie with talking, become a director, become a writer, and have an incredible life.
So, Olia, what's interesting about this film actually is it's an animated movie, right?
Exactly. And it's made by Sylvain Chaumet, who made The Triplet de Belleville. He also made The Illusionist. He spent years and years painstakingly making hand-drawn images for Marcel. And this animation allows for fantasy because in the film we meet the ghost of Pagnol's boyhood self, who helps Pagnol as an older man write his memoirs for a magazine column. And together they relive events, including at the very beginning the death of Pagnol's mother when he was a young boy. This really affected him, and it continues to affect him throughout his life. We also see moments throughout the Second World War when the Nazis came to France. But we also see Marcel struggling with his artistic flops. Believe it or not, he's famous, but he also had moments where, you know, things didn't work out. Sylvain Chaumet makes a point of keeping the distinctive southern accent in the film. This was something of pride for Pagnol, who continued this this accent in all of his writing. It's melodious, it's full of idiomatic expressions, it's very theatrical, and it makes for some very, very funny moments.
Un jour, maman, tu seras fière de moi.
Et pourquoi tu n'écrirais pas une pièce qui se passerait chez vous, à Marseille?
We can see that Chaumet pays tribute to the filmmaking process. We can see Marcel Pagnol filming outside. He films with non-professional actors or theatre actors. So he was also credited with influencing filmmakers in the decades to come, including even New Wave movement filmmakers.
So Pagnol was the president of the Cannes Film Festival jury in 1955. Today, 70 years later, the president is Juliette Binoche. And this festival has evolved a bit, right? And a big issue has been sex abuse in the film industry.
Indeed. In fact, this year's festival seems to be taking it extremely seriously, or more seriously than it did before. During the opening ceremony last week, for example, the host, the MC, Laurent Lafitte, actually paid tribute to French actress Adèle Hanel, who famously quit the industry because of its culture of abuse and impunity. But at the time, her move was met with relative indifference. However, this year, the festival's really made it very clear that producers of films have to guarantee the safety, the integrity, the dignity of all contributors.
And of course, the festival opened on this backdrop of this guilty verdict of Gérard Depardieu, the film giant who was found guilty, right, of sexual abuse of two women on a film set. This was right before the festival opened. He was given a suspended jail sentence, and some are saying this is a groundbreaking verdict.
Yes, definitely groundbreaking for the industry. In fact, my co-workers spoke to Fanny de Casimaker, who's the director of the 50-50 Me Too Collective here in France, about that verdict.
C'est une figure de Depardieu un peu légendaire.
She's saying that Depardieu is legendary. But we don't want the focus to only be on him. He's obviously one important person in the industry, but we don't want him to be the tree that hides the forest and that keeps us from addressing the systematic abuses that go on in the industry today. Now, the jury president, Juliette Binoche, said that the verdict would, of course, never have happened without the Me Too movement, which is interesting. In France, that was jump-started in 2017 by the actress Judith Godrèche, who was among the first to speak out against the American producer Harvey Weinstein. And of course, we know what happened after that. A lot of actresses also came forward with accusations, and it really rocked the cinema world. Also, Sarah, you'll remember there was, in the weeks before Cannes, a parliamentary inquiry into the entertainment industry concluded that moral, sexist and sexual violence in the cultural sector is systemic, endemic and persistent. So yeah, we'll have to see how all of this gets addressed in the industry at large. But here in Cannes, at least, things are shifting a little bit.
We've come to the end of the show. Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International, and this episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
We'll be taking a break from the podcast for a little bit, might be for a while. In the meantime, you can listen to past shows on rfienglish.com or on your favorite podcast app.
And if you want to send us a note, please do. You can write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr.
And look for photos and videos on the stories we've covered on our Instagram page, Spotlight on France. Bye, Alison.
Bye-bye, Sarah. J'assume.